Welcome back to Troubled, a podcast by survivors of institutional abuse for survivors and the general public. And welcome to my super special birthday episode. My birthday, April 29th, is now and forevermore the memorial for justice for Cornelius. It's officially been 1 year since the murder of 16-year-old foster child Cornelius Frederick at Lakeside Academy in Kalamazoo, Michigan, owned and operated by Sequel Youth and Family Services, owned by Altamont Capital Group, both of which are run by Bain executives, and we know how Bain is. So scoop the website for updates on everything that you can get involved with today if you're listening to this in real time, and definitely check out the National Juvenile Justice Network's 1 year progress report for Shutdown Sequel. We will link that in the description of the show notes. Trigger warning, and I just want to validate that for survivors with episodes when we are interviewing staff, especially for those of us from the tough love realm, it's hard to understand how anyone who's not a predator would be in this situation. But we are going to interview Megan from Lakeside. She was the director of case management and Corn's direct case manager. And she's one of the few staff that stayed in the burning house to protect their kids. And one of the fewer still who speak out before the ashes have settled. Most of us have many questions about the missing portions of footage during Corn's restraint. So let's just jump straight into that with someone who was in the room.
The footage that was given to the state and that FIGER released last year was obviously not a continuous footage. You know, it wasn't, there was obviously chunks missing, but the question is whether that was some sort of accidental technological glitch. I know there was something about those cameras are motion censored or something of that nature, but it also sounds like there are specific things that were missing. So that makes it seem like it's very deliberate that they deliberately edited this footage that they released in a public capacity.
Correct. It's difficult because at times there were camera issues, you know, it's technology. But considering what happened that day and the times that are missing, it just doesn't match up. There were reports from other staff members that were there specifically and staff members who reviewed the cameras very shortly after that reported that there was parts of the video and that there were actions by supervisors and other people in that room that probably would have got them in some more trouble. And it seems that those were deleted. So I know that the take has been, you know, again, oh, it's technology, these things skip. And if it's motion censored, well, then does that mean they were really just standing there and the camera didn't pick up motion? Because that's also an issue as to why they weren't acting. So what I was told, like, because they took away my access to the videos a couple months before all this happened because I kept reporting things. So I got kicked out. So I didn't have access to the videos when it first happened. But there was a person that did have access that let me basically see the video. And I don't know specifically who would have been able to do so. And of course, they all deny that it happened, but there is sure. Like definitely a chunk of time missing. And during that chunk of time, what was reported to me that initially happened is that our group living director, who is like one of the highest of management there, threw water on Cornelius's face twice. They didn't do anything. And that somehow was never in the video.
And did you see that clip or did someone report that to you?
Someone reported it. And so that's been my hard thing is like, since they took my video, you know, like I never fully saw it, but I trust the people who reported it to me. And those people that were in that room, like confirmed that that person did that. But to say, like, I don't know if I could specifically say this person edited it because there was multiple people in management that could have done it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was done at Lakeside. I don't know if Sequel came in and did it.
We don't need to point fingers on that. I just didn't know if they had removed that person from the video, mm-hmm. like if they were trying to hide that person or if they were just trying to hide the situation with the water.
Just the situation, because he stayed in there. I mean, after that happened, and of course, then tried to play, oh my gosh, I had no idea what was going on. And they actually let him stay on. Like, he still stayed there after that. Like, everyone else that was involved got let go. Multiple people that
were also just in the room and didn't act, got put on the registry, like the child abuse registry of Michigan. And somehow he didn't. And the one other supervisor whose dad works at DHS or something, those two were able to somehow not get in trouble, basically.
Can we name that guy, or is there a reason why we wouldn't be able to name that guy? Because I'm imagining he still works for Sequel.
Last I knew, they let him go. Okay. I mean, because they kicked him out like 2 weeks later. Who knows if he's allowed to come back, but he was let go. It was never a fire. It was a mutual agreement. I'm assuming he still got all of his, you know, time out and all that stuff. But yeah, so his name was, I mean, I don't mind. His name was Brad Hodge. He was the group living director, and he pretty much oversaw the staff and knew what was going on and basically covered for his staff, and had been there for 8 years, only had a high school diploma. His brother worked there. His son worked there. So again, it was keeping it in the family situation.
To assume that things were deliberately either done off camera or that records or video was tampered with, that wouldn't be too far outside of the culture with Sequel, would it be?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there was a time when there wasn't a ton of video cameras. It was actually a request or a kind of mandate by California that more cameras get put in because there was so many complaints being filed and so many allegations. And so Lakeside basically had to comply and put more cameras around. And those cameras were put like outside and in classrooms because there were places that staff would specifically take kids to restrain them. And obviously, if you have to go off camera to do so, it's probably not proper. So they just found other places. And I've said time and time again, unfortunately, that if this incident with Cornelius did not happen right there in the cafeteria where there was cameras, we probably would have a different story. You know, we probably would have been given some type of a freak accident. You know, I mean, they would have been able to cover themselves just like they did. There were multiple other cases open with other students who had pretty significant injuries at that time. Students who had, you know, dislocated shoulders and a broken collarbone, and students who were bruised all around their torso. And this had been happening, you know, just a month or two before Cornelius. And all those students were, quote unquote, you know, taken off camera to talk and came out injured. So that was common. That was culture. I mean, they knew where they could go and how to get around those types of things.
Well, speaking of the culture, can you explain for just, you know, briefly for those of us who don't know anything about the Diamond model, how the Diamond model fit into Lakeside and Sequel's training and what that means?
Yeah. So when I first went through training, you know, it was kind of explained as this is the Diamond. We don't talk about it in front of kids. It was like studying psychology was kind of a weird concept because at first you feel, why are we classifying these kids? You know, why are we putting them in certain categories? And it was really kind of pitched to us that we do this to help our staff, to help us know how we can best control the groups and control the dorms and use positive peer reinforcement and positive peer culture to get, you know, maybe some of our older students or students who are doing well to help some of the younger and not so well kids on the Diamond do better. And so it was really kind of pitched as almost like a therapeutic process. And so, of course, you know, coming in, I had never worked at a residential. I'm like, all right, maybe this is what we do. But more and more that you go to these weekly team meetings, and, you know, Cornelius was a lot of the time at the what they call the lower half of the Diamond. So kids that are either isolates, so that they just kind of chill on their own, students who are what they call scapegoats. So the ones that all the kids are either pinning things on or they're willing to get things pinned on them, you know, that kind of thing. And then you had the upper half, which are the basically lieutenants and the leaders. And these are the kids we can use to basically get done what we want to get done. And it really is just, I don't know how to explain it, but it's demeaning, you know, it's it's crappy to put these kids in these categories and not really take into account why that student might be an isolator, why that student might be okay with being a gopher, which is someone that would basically go for anything another peer asked them to do, and not take into account their trauma. And instead of healthily saying, how can we get the student to maybe, you know, be more interactive or choose better decisions, they just would, okay, well, he did this week, so now he's negative. So for corn, you know, again, being the Sour Patch Kid he was always grouped, you know, with the slower half. So automatically, just because of where he fell on that diamond, you know, okay, well, now he's not making progress, and now he's this, and now he, you know, just constantly knocking him down because of his trying, you know, being, having to protect himself, because that's what he had to do the last 4 years. The diamond, I guess it was started with SQL, and it's a very SQL specific training, and they believe in it. They believe it's a positive culture, you know, for peers to basically hold each other accountable, so they call. And that even led to, you know, of course, sometimes physically holding each other accountable. So
that's what I'd like to ask you about. You know, obviously, I think we can both agree that it's pretty, not just demoralizing, but potentially dehumanizing, just to put them on this grid and have that affect their progress in their environment. But when you say using the kids to get what you need to get done, and you talk about the physical element, like, what's a 30 on 30? Like, what is this?
Yeah, there were definitely certain, I was going to say dorms, because I mean, it was started out as certain units were more known for, I guess, letting kids run things. But they started mixing the general residential with the mental health cases, and it just kind of went real downhill from there. So anyways, you might have, you know, for example, Cornelius came in as a mental health abuse and neglect youth. He was on those units to begin with, and because of his stature and, oh, he's a bully, he's mean, he's this and that, he got moved to the general residential units. And just from a perspective, not to say that the general residential units don't have trauma and need mental health care as well, they just have sometimes a different way of functioning. So Cornelia, you know, Cornelius, or even some of the younger students, or maybe students who just came in and wanted to challenge staff, if they were having issues, those staff would go to some of the leaders and lieutenants and higher up kids and be like, hey, why don't you, you know, show Cornelius how we do things over here. And one of the only places there weren't cameras were the bedrooms. And so a lot of times, you know, a youth might, oh, let me go help, you know, this peer put away their laundry, or let me show them how to make their beds. And it ends up being basically a 30 seconds of someone watches the door and the kids beat each other up. And you know, they knew, like, oh, you don't mess with certain staff. So if that staff says, hey, this kid didn't want to follow instructions today, you know, whether it be right then, maybe it's during bedtime or whatever, but the kids are going to get redemption almost for that staff. So another reason why, you know, students like Cornelius and others had to almost come off as this intimidation, you know, I got to protect myself, because staff were letting other students physically, you know, quote unquote, put them in check. So, I mean, this was pretty common. And if a student did report it and, oh, okay, well, we got caught this time, so they would do an incident report and, oh, we didn't see, you know, Johnny go into this room, and, you know, just kind of played it off as it was not a staff issue, but it really did come down to staff would almost set these things up. So,
right. I wanted to clarify the difference between letting kids handle things amongst themselves is very different from, hey, Johnny pissed me off earlier, go show him what mm-hmm. we're all about. And then a staff member actually watching the door while a child is jumped by another child.
Right. Yeah. Or they, you know, like I said, they would, there was an incident where there were youth that were fighting and a staff got punched during it. And that staff member was kind of a lower level staff member. And so the upper staff were like, hey man, we got you. We're going to show these kids they can't do that to our team. And,
you know, that's how they kind of got the staff into the culture. Like, oh, you're a new guy. They don't know any better. I'm gonna show them. And those staff members actually pulled that student into one of the hallways between the dorms, into one of the offices, and beat them up for that staff member. So that staff member now felt, you know, oh, I'm part of this group. They're going to protect me. And these kids are awful. And then those kids know, okay, yeah, staff don't care. They're going to kick my ass. You know, they know they were protected. So that was also another big piece of the culture, is that as a staff member, you either kind of got roped into that, or you were one of the ones that were trying to fight it, but could only do so much, or you wouldn't have a job, you know? So it's this fine line of wanting to be there for the students and the kids, knowing what was going on, but really not being able to stop it almost. It was a very abusive relationship for a lot of our staff members. It was hard, but you couldn't imagine not being there for the kids. And I would say, you know, 90% of our staff dedicated their lives to being there and really believed in trying to be there for these kids. But you were fighting a bigger power. You were fighting the system, and it was defeating. It almost seemed like there was no winning. And then to finally see one of our students die, I mean, you just, everything you feared and kind of held your breath every day when you came into work happened, and there was nothing we could do. You know, there was no bringing Cornelius back. There was no bringing a peer back for the students. There was, you know, no letting his family be there and say goodbye. I mean, it was a culmination of everything that we had been trying to fight for a year before that. But SQL and the management at Lakeside didn't care. I mean, it came down to money and it came down to power, and we looked good on paper, so they were allowed to keep abusing.
Right. This is a facility for traumatized children that are wards of the state. This isn't some Hard Knocks prison from like the 1970s when this behavior was still, you know, they were getting away with it. This is illegal with adults in prison, all of this that's going on. And it's just horrifying that this is the model. And if this is how SQL is at Lakeside, why would we expect SQL to train their staff around the country any differently?
Right. And there were times where staff would be sent to other facilities if they were short-staffed or if they were, you know, having trouble. And so staff would come back and pretty much have the same stories, if not worse. You know, oh my gosh, those kids are so out of control. This happened. And just so much violence. And again, it just was, it's always pushed back onto the youth. It was always, they're horrible kids, or this happened, or, you know, their trauma. And I mean, at Lakeside, I can even say there were times that you just felt crazy because you kept questioning it, but management had been there for so long, you know, you're like, okay, well, how am I supposed to go against someone that's been with the company 10, 12 plus years? So when caseworkers or probation officers or parents, you know, started raising these concerns, are they going to listen to a kid that has been put all these diagnoses on, you know, and a case manager or a therapist or whoever who had only been there for a couple of years? Or are they going to listen to, you know, one of the directors that had been there for X amount of time and has seen so many kids like them? And you know, so they knew how to talk their way around these things. And that's not just Lakeside, that's across the board, you know. SQL, like I said, knew how to do things on paper. They knew how to offer all this great training and great curriculum, but it wasn't really being implemented. And they were just getting better at covering it up until they couldn't, you know.
Well, speaking of these great, amazing, idealistic notions not being implemented in the cover-ups, what about, I mean, that sounds like, is there medical fraud? Like, what's going on with that if they're billing these states for all these therapies and then they're just restraining kids off camera and having them fight each other?
Right. Yeah, that was something that I guess we didn't really know or like could say was going on when you were in the moment, because departments were kept so separate. Like I, you know, oversaw case management, and that was pretty much, I was told to kind of stay in my lane. So I had no idea about, you know, what nursing did or what this place did. You know, you're kind of just
almost kept segregated so that there aren't a lot of questions, you know? So the most that we could see was, okay, you know, I could pull up the student's record and at least see if he went to the psychiatrist or could see if he went to the dentist and some notes on it. And same with therapy. But again, of course, a therapeutic relationship, sometimes we want to keep the confidentiality. So I don't want to go see this student's record and see all the things they talked about with their therapist and things like that. So it was hidden from some departments, I guess you could say, in the system. So what came about is that the therapist might say that Cornelius attended boys council, which was, you know, like a weekly group, anger management counseling, which again was a weekly group, and then individual therapy. And whoever does the billing for the Medicaid, they just see that there's these group sessions or individual sessions. So all of those get billed. But if you go into the actual notes, it might say that the student refused, or the student didn't participate, or that this session was canceled because the therapist was out, you know, which all might be valid. They might have just been put in there. I mean, you know, who's to say that? But regardless, everything was billed for, even though many of those groups and sessions were not taking place. So we're saying that the student is getting all of this therapy and all these things, and it might not actually really be happening. And then at other times, you know, that also affects how long that student is staying there. So if the student hasn't shown enough progress in his anger classes or his substance abuse classes, which may be to no fault of their own if they weren't happening, then that just prolongs their stay, which prolongs the money, which prolongs the contract, you know, and it just was a cycle. So there was definitely times where things were getting billed and they weren't happening. And again, it was just a disservice to the kids. I mean, that's what they were there for. But again, they found ways around it. And then of course it's blamed again on the student for why they're not progressing. And no student's perfect. I mean, Cornelius wasn't perfect, but it definitely doesn't mean that he didn't deserve the services that might have actually helped him.
Right. So that's like literally what UHS settled with the DOJ like a year or so ago on $117 million because they were billing Medicaid and all these things for therapies that were never happening. They were changing diagnosis, prolonging stays, and they had the restraint and seclusion issues as well. When we hear about this culture, I think something that's really tough for some people, especially in my position, it's like, how can you stay in a culture that's this toxic? But to your point, of these people, especially these people who are taking these $12 an hour job and have devoted their lives to kids, I think that there's a cult and a coercive control mentality, but also people like yourself were genuinely trying to make moves to get these kids to safety. I mean, with your situation with Corn, what about this transfer request? You had put in a transfer request for Corn, right?
Yeah, because I mean, typically Lakeside is, or was, kind of pitched as like a 6 to 12 month program, depending on, you know, of course, when they come in, like what they need and things of that nature. So for Cornelius, he was one of my first male cases on the mental health unit. And it had been, you know, almost 18 months and we weren't seeing a lot of progress. You know, like, I mean, like I said, on paper, Cornelius was a tough kid, still getting restrained, not doing this, refusing therapy, you know, all these things that we could list. And on the surface, you know, again, everyone was kind of pushing, oh, you know, Cornelius is just a big baby and blah, blah, blah. And, but there was a group of us that were trying to be like, we got to get this kid out of here. And not just Corn, there was a lot of students. And so we had, I don't know specific, but I want to say it was like 2 weeks or so. Like we had a meeting. It was me, his case manager at the time, and his DHS worker. And we kind of were like, hey, like, we need another placement. We had been asking prior to that, but it wasn't as urgent. And it was always, well, he's safe there. We don't have anywhere else. Oh, well, there's nothing on the adoption. You know, we can't put him anywhere. He had been through almost every placement in Detroit. So again, the state felt, well, he's safe enough there and we haven't seen enough progress. So we'll just keep him there. And we were kind of pushing back on that. He had been here for 18 months. Clearly this is not working for him. He's not getting better here. And there were some other mental health concerns that I thought he needed different programming for. So we had this meeting with his DHS worker and it
it just seemed kind of fall on deaf ears. She was like, oh yeah, I've been looking, and we just didn't really hear anything. So the week of the incident, we actually put in like a 30-day removal, which is a formal request to say, you have 30 days. We really need some movement here. And of course, it's not to say at the end of 30 days we were going to kick a student out, but it was more so to just put pressure on the state. So they had documentation saying the student needed something else. And in that letter, we would document why our facility was no longer, you know, the best fit. So we put that removal notice in 2 or 3 days before the incident happened. And that's something that, you know, just, it'll haunt you, because it's just, you know, the state definitely let him down too. So many students like him just fall through the cracks. And these teenage boys that they don't have anywhere else to go, nothing else to do. They feel like they're safe enough in these facilities, and they just get forgotten about. And Cornelius would constantly ask me, he didn't really want to talk to his worker, because again, it's someone you see once a month who never has any positive news for you. And all he'd want to know is, all right, where am I going next? And there was just never really an answer. And he would tell me, like, Miss Megan, like, what do I have to look forward to? There's nothing next. I don't care. You know, this, that, and the third. So him being 16, we were just trying to get him to the point where we could prove that maybe he could do, you know, a semi-independent living program or just a next step. But they just kept saying that he wasn't stable enough, and he was still getting in fights and doing this. And again, so, you know, it just got put back on his behaviors. So when I knew that independent living wasn't going to be looking like an option, that's when we started pushing, trying to get him somewhere else. And it was just, you know, it's a little too late.
I think when we're asking for justice for a murdered child, everything's a little bit too little too late. He was failed at every mark, you know, everything that happened. I think the closest we'll ever come to being able to write that is with the work that you and everyone else are doing now to make sure that it's not just blown over and forgotten about. However long it takes, this has to be his legacy, not in that he was killed in this way, but that, and he could possibly save other children. I mean, including his own siblings who are still institutionalized in Michigan's care.
Right. Yep. I know that would be one of his, you know, last wishes. I mean, he wanted nothing more than to talk with his sisters and be with his sisters. And he was constantly worried about them. I mean, he was, you know, the man of the household pretty much, and wanted to protect them. And they weren't allowed a lot of contact, if any at all, with some of them, you know, has to go through this worker to who they're staying with. And so, I mean, that broke his heart. And he would do anything, not only for his sisters, but any student, to not have to go through this. So I know that he would want, you know, change. He would give the shirt off his back, be there for the students, even if he had his moments. So,
yeah. Well, he's a 16-year-old with extreme trauma in a completely unimaginable situation. I think we talked about this, like, with the narrative that goes around about him, you know, when these kids die in these facilities and they try to make it out like they were bad kids or delinquents, if you will. I mean, firstly, that's not why he was institutionalized in the first place. And secondly, if someone's not trauma informed to understand why a child would have to be tough on the exterior, then, you know, they're not our audience. But the incident, unfortunately, was unavoidable. Speaking of that, what was that like to be there that day? How did the kids handle it?
God, you know, even a year later, it's just, I still have to, like, process what happened, you know? I actually had no idea, like, what initially had happened. I was on a phone call with a probation officer and another student, and that student was supposed to be going to lunch. So I walk in the calf, and at that point, the restraint had ended. All the staff that were pretty much initially involved were gone. So I did see the tables kind of moved, and I saw a bunch of the directors standing around, and didn't really, again, unfortunately, it was normal for a student to be on the ground after a restraint happened, you know? So I'm thinking, okay, maybe they're calming down, things like that. And I saw one of my case managers, and I walked up, I said, what happened? And I realized it was Cornelius, and my heart kind of stopped, but all the kids were eating lunch, you know? So I was just really confused at that point. Was it like a medical incident?
did he fall and hit his head? I mean, I had no idea until he said, no, it was a restraint. I said, okay, well, what's going on? And again, I saw the program director, the group living director, the director of nursing, one of the dorm supervisors, like all these people that, you know, were part of the higher. I'm like, of course, if something's wrong, they would be doing something, right? And everyone was just standing around kind of looking at each other. And I finally was walked up to him and realized he's not moving, you know? And I was in shock for a moment. And then when I bent down and couldn't find his pulse, I again was like, what is going on? Because again, no one was doing anything. And so I asked the guys to kind of help him, like turn him on his side. You know, let's try and clear his airway. I mean, just asking what's going on. And that's the point where the nurse finally called 911. And again, at this point, I had no idea how long he had been down, no idea why he was unresponsive. You know, just the fact that my student is not breathing. And what do you do at that point? Because the nurse is standing here, and I'm wondering what's going on. And so I immediately turn around and tell the staff, I'm like, get the kids out of this cast. Why they had all been eating in here was beyond me. Because even if they didn't know at that time, knowing what was going to happen afterwards, you sat there, you know, you were sitting there eating while your peer died. Like what kid should be exposed to that? So they cleared the calf. We tried to find a pulse again. I couldn't find anything. I started like, where's the AED? Let's get scissors, you know, kind of all started running around. And that part was also clipped out of the video, which I found interesting because that was something I was part of. And I realized it wasn't in the video, was us running to get the AED and get scissors and cut open his shirt. And by that time, the other nurses that were on campus did come in there. So they had taken over CPR. And when you hear that AED machine say like that there's no pulse and to begin compressions, there's no words. There's no words other than to start flashing back to that whole time you spent with that student, all the staff that spent time with this student, and that he was gone. So of course, you know, they did keep trying, but there was nothing. They pretty much told us that EMS was on the way. So I start, you know, hey, let's clear tables. Someone be directing, you know, let's get them up here, all that kind of stuff. So when EMS got there, one of the directors actually then kicked us out of the cafeteria, which of course was upsetting to us. They were like, oh, you need to go to the units. You need to be with the kids. And I'm like, shouldn't we talk to the police or something? Like we were kind of just here involved in this incident. Also to mention the fact that we just tried to help revive one of our students. Can I have a minute to process? But no, we were just yelled at, told to go to the dorms. We weren't allowed to be there. We weren't allowed to watch. We weren't allowed to talk to police, nothing. At that point, I was like, you know what, right now I do need to be with some of those students. So I went to one of the dorms, you know, and talked with the kids. And of course, they're all like, what's going on? What happened to them? You know, just seeing the sirens and hearing the ambulance, that's a trigger already for most of our students. So it was pretty upsetting. They did, EMS apparently, from what we were told, did find, you know, a pulse, and they were able to get him to the hospital. And then we all got sent home the next day. No one talked about it. We weren't allowed to talk about it. Basically, we weren't allowed to ask questions. They wouldn't tell us if he was alive. It was just kind of it didn't happen. We need to be here for our students type of deal. And again, that just didn't sit right with me. And then, of course, police, CPS, the sequel attorney, everyone was calling, everyone was up there. We had to write statements and what we saw. And again, at that point, I still didn't know exactly what happened until one of the police asked me, do you know why they would wait 12 minutes to do anything? And I was like, what do you mean? And they were like, well, the restraint happened and staff waited. Like, isn't your training that you're supposed to do something? And, you know, they waited 12 minutes until they called EMS. And I just didn't have an answer. I still don't have an answer. And that's when it kind of sunk in that our staff did it. Our staff and the management and everyone else that we had been saying and asking and telling and yelling and raising red flags for months before this, our worst fear happened right there.
So again, that day, that was the day after, we still weren't really told much. Kids didn't know much. And then it was that following morning, which I believe was Friday morning, one of the staff told the students before the rest of it, like before we even knew. And everything just broke loose. I mean, kids were beyond words, which was valid. I was like, I'm not mad at any kids for being mad. I'm not mad for kids running around this campus. They just witnessed one of their peers die by staff that they're supposed to trust. And these staff that are here, and they knew. It got pretty violent. Students were running off campus. You know, students were yelling at staff, yelling at directors. And then it turned towards each other and actually became kind of a race war, which I'm still not sure how that came about, but it got pretty violent and ugly. And they called the police. At first, only one or two units came, and we were kind of keeping the group separate. I mean, I was walking around with one of the groups and just talking them down and, hey, guys, you know, this isn't worth it. You guys already know you're about to leave because of what just happened. Let's not make it worse and things like that. And they kind of finally met up in the parking lot, and there just wasn't enough of us, to be honest. So the police called more units. They started pepper spraying the kids, pepper spraying the staff, arresting students, putting them in the back of the cars. So then the students started attacking the cars and trying to break out windows. I mean, we couldn't stop it. And they went into the calf, took all the milk. So they're now dumping milk all over each other. It's just a scene that you would think was in a movie. I still just can't believe we were in the midst of it, trying to separate kids. You know, pretty much everything went out the window at that point. We were just trying to make it as little harm as possible. And there were some, again, of management staff saying, oh, he died of COVID. And I looked at them, I was like, are you seriously gonna say that right now? And the kids know what happened. They know that he didn't die of COVID. And they literally turned to that staff and were like, fuck you, you killed him. And after that, it just, staff knew that we really had no control over campus at that point. The students eventually did help their peer, like, hey man, you know, break it up. They all went back to the units. But of course, that didn't stop it. We just separated everybody. So we had some units that were, you know, a lot of the Latino, Hispanic kind of group, and whole units that were the African-American, Black, you know, it became just a huge divide. We had to call in staff from other placements. We had to call in security. They hired a security company, which was kind of just the presence of it. But I mean, they weren't going to touch the kids. They pretty much just called the cops, which that kids don't care if the cops are there. The cops weren't taking anybody because of COVID, and the kids knew that. And so it was intense. It was scary. I think that there were definitely students that, I don't know how to put it. I mean, even though it was a lot, I felt okay, because I knew that the students weren't necessarily mad at me, and I validated that they were allowed to be mad, and of course wanted them to make good decisions, but also was like, I don't care, because I hate this place too. So I mean, we were going in at 4 or 5 a.m. kind of trying to get there before they woke up, and staying until 1 or 2, come home, shower, sleep for a minute, and go back. And counties just wouldn't, you know, get a hold of me. Hey, we're going to be there Saturday at 11. So I'd have to get every kid from that county, you know, to be able to go. And then it just slowly started taking student by student. Of course, California had 36 students there. How do you get 36 students across the country? That was a fun game to tackle. And they eventually had to send out a whole 737 with like 30 probation officers from all different counties. And we had to drive those students ourselves in the big vans and get them out of there. And COVID and all, that was that was another, you know, tackle, is we had kids who were positive, negative, and that didn't matter, you know. They played COVID off the whole time because they didn't want to scare the kids. And at the end of it, we had all these staff and, you know, a third of our kids all had it. And that was tough too, because it, you know, it was the beginning of it. No one knew what COVID was going to be. So that was scary.
Yeah, it was 2 weeks of a lot of emotions and trauma to the students, to staff, saying goodbye to 125 kids that you'll not know where they're going, never know if you're going to hear from them again. I believe we've had 7 students die since then, just by having to go back to those environments, and a lot of self-harm. And that's, you know, a whole nother side of things that a lot of people don't realize is this aftermath. We're all left just broken. So yeah, it was a lot. It was something that literally just felt like a movie while you were in it, and has taken a year to be able to even talk about and think about and process, and time to hold some accountability, you know, to let people know this is what happened, and Sequel and their management and their need for money and their greed to profit off of these youth who are put into the system wanting help and getting treated like this is just beyond words.
100% agree. As someone who during breakfast 17 years ago watched a 16-year-old boy die at my program, I can't imagine what the kids and all y'all were dealing with the fact that this was a restraint-induced situation. I mean, the idea that like you're a kid in this, and we've already gone through how intense this experience is, but then to know that they can go so far as to kill you, you know, you could literally die. And then it is, like you said, it was like the first 2 months of COVID really being a thing nationally, and how horrifying that is. So I can't imagine. And then you're right, no one's talking about the trauma to everyone involved from what they went through and experienced here. There's no support of that. A lot of the people that contacted us last year when this happened were parents or relatives of kids that mm-hmm. were at Lakeside that knew Corn, and that after the situation wound up in juvenile justice or in another lockdown, and they felt they were being targeted because they were speaking up about Cornelius's death. And that's horrifying as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when counties, for example, like if we had 7 youth from, you know, Minnesota, it really came down to, we're obviously taking our students, but if they were somewhat close to finishing the program, they were allowed to go home. Almost everyone else got sent to juvie, was found another placement. We had to drive students to placements. There was a student I was really close with, and he was finally getting on track in our program, finally doing well. And I say finally because he was hard-headed and took a little bit longer than, you know, what they expected. And instead of going home, he got put in another placement that was even more secure, from my understanding, and not a good place. And so, of course, to its youth, that's defeating. You finally put in all this work and you get placed somewhere else. So he ran from that facility. And about a month after that, I get a call from his worker. And I'm thinking, of course, you know, hey, they're missing paperwork, maybe they need something. But she calls to tell me that after he ran from there, was taking it hard, everything that happened, and got involved in some things he shouldn't have, and was shot and killed and left in the street. And, you know, it's, you're just angry because, of course, you didn't want them to necessarily stay at Lakeside. You didn't want them to stay there with all of that, but you knew at least they were somewhere that you could see them. You were trying to protect them, to know that they just went back out into this world to be lost to, you know, gun violence and gang violence. Several students committing suicide, just the burdens and everything that happened was unimaginable. And for parents and for other students. And that's another thing that so many of us replay is the parents that were concerned, and we had nothing to prove it. You know, I know that there's parents that I had to talk with, and all I could say is this case has been closed. I have nothing that I can say that you know, their student had made allegations, and the students, like, the staff is doing this. And people would come in, and of course it was covered up. And like in my gut, I knew that the student was telling the truth, but the state closed it, you know, Lakeside closed it, Licensor closed it. So now this kid's a liar.
And I had to tell those parents, you know, that their child was staying there regardless of their fears, regardless of how much they wanted them home, because I was nothing, you know, I had no power over that. And I wish I could have called every parent and apologized. You knew that something was going on, but again, it came down to, are they going to listen to some kid that they're going to say is, you know, bipolar or this, or has trauma with, you know, men and, you know, some case manager, or are they going to listen to the program directors and the executive director and the licensor who have been doing this for 10, whatever plus years. So we just kept getting silenced. I mean, there were so many cases that were open that I was like, I know this kid's telling the truth, and it would be closed. And so you literally couldn't do anything. What was I going to do? Call again? They're going to say, no, we already looked at this, and they're going to stop answering. And they put specific policies and procedures in place so that they basically could get ahead of these calls. You weren't allowed to call, you know, as mandated reporters without letting management know. And they would be the ones to say, oh, we reviewed the cameras, it's fine, you know, this, that, and the third. And it, you know, so what do you do? It's just all all a mess, especially when the state and the licensor are just as corrupt as the place you were working. They knew what was going on too, and they didn't care, you know, because of course they're making money off of it too.
Well, I hold everyone who is profiting off this but isn't willing to take accountability responsible, and I hold Sequel responsible for the deaths of your students as well.
Agreed.
Speaking of who is getting held responsible, not that any of the three charges are actually going anywhere, but it's, you know, a couple of your coworkers and the nurse. I feel differently about the two of them, and I think I'll let like Emergent Justice really speak for that, and we can all discuss that, I guess, if people are listening to this in real time tonight at the memorial event. But per the nurse, that's just a different level for me, because she's literally licensed, you know, to protect mm-hmm. people and to offer this kind of support. And then I hear that she's actually kind of connected.
Yeah. There was a lot of family relations that you don't necessarily know about until you're really in the mix with everything. So the nurse, gosh, I think she had been with Sequel like 10 plus years. So not only was she our director of nursing, but I believe also the regional director of nursing, which means that she helped other Sequel facilities. They are each kind of split up into like parts of the country. And so, you know, they would meet and, hey, this is what we're doing, and this is how we're documenting, or whatever that the nursing was going to be in charge of. Again, when I started questioning and, you know, came into the cafeteria, it was almost like the nurse was frozen. And honestly, before that, I had the utmost respect for her. I really hadn't ever seen her not be involved with, you know, students. There were plenty of times where parents were calling me at 7, 8, 9 o'clock at night, you know, just because of different time zones. And if I reached out to her, she would be responsive, you know? So I really didn't understand in that moment what she was doing, you know? And it kind of hit me that I felt like she probably wasn't doing anything because she already knew it was too late. But again, I also didn't know in that moment that she had already been there for 12 minutes. So when the police footage came out, and to hear her say, well, I thought he was faking it, it's just infuriating. Because A, anyone, nurse, staff, me, anyone knows Cornelius is not going to just lay there. Cornelius may have taken 10, 15 seconds, and then he was going to be back up. He was going to be talking crap. All right, man, I got you later. I got you lit, you know, and continue about his day. It just, the matter is, Cornelius was not just going to lay there, especially after he urinated himself, because that is something he had an issue with and was very embarrassed of. And staff had been working, you know, had always worked with him with that. So that was my other sign that when I saw that, Cornelius wouldn't just sit there in that, you know. So yeah, it just, as a regular staff, if I saw those things and I tried to get him up and he didn't move, I think I would kind of know the faking thing wasn't factual, like that just wasn't going to happen. But then also as a nurse, the director of nursing, you're, like you said, that is your job out of anyone on that campus. How did we not, you know, maybe if we had acted 10 minutes sooner, maybe we would have had a different outcome with this. You know, maybe that could have been something different. So as a nurse, I don't know. I people ask me all the time why they didn't do something, and I don't have an answer, because the faking thing doesn't sit right with me. We know Cornelius. And if you knew it was too late, you still sure damn should have tried. Just the end of it. And as far as the, you know, connections with her, she is related by marriage to the HR, who was the HR director. So of course, I can't imagine as the HR director having to look into this case, having to give information to police, having to, you know, go through video footage, everything that came with this, having to lay people off, having to fire people, having to talk with licensing and see the whole works, and knowing that your family or your family member was directly involved with this incident. You know, my heart goes out for them regardless of the situation. I would never want to, you know, deal with this incident, but also not deal with my family member in this incident. There were questions about if things were trying to be skewed because of who they were trying to protect. There were questions of, you know, like you had mentioned, the video, if any of that was changed due to, you know, who was there. So that definitely is something that's been brought up. And I don't have specific answers, but I just can imagine that would have been really difficult.
Yeah, I don't think any of us have a lot of answers, because unfortunately not enough time and effort has been put into figuring out what really happened and what really happened after. But I think it's fair to question how, when you have multiple situations with the same management staff removed from the video, how that could be a coincidence. Like, if it really is just a random tech glitch, both of those waters in his face situations were completely removed. It's not like we missed part of it. Those were completely removed. It just doesn't seem too coincidental with that one. And doesn't her family member, isn't she doing something with IT or something like the data jazz, so she has access to the videos and whatnot?
Right. I know that. So there was a group of us that had stayed on basically at Lakeside after even all the students were gone, just because there was so much to keep up with, you know, closing out files, dealing with the rest of staff, things like that. So she stayed on even until after I left. And I was informed that the HR director went to work for Willits Technologies, I believe, or Willits Incorporated or something, which ran all of SQL's tech base. So they ran our system of keeping files and, you know, the therapy notes we talked about in the videos and anything that was in our system, they ran. So again, that was brought up as a concern as to SQL's really good at just moving people around. And if you are in that group, you know, they're going to protect you. So I think that maybe being directly under SQL was a little bit much due to those connections. So she went to work with, like I said, Willits. I don't know if that person is still, you know, if they're still there, what their title, like, I don't know what that was, but there was a lot of speculation as to, again, kind of just being coincidental that you are working with the technology, and there's been so many questions about what happened with the technology and the files and, you know, things like that. So after the incident with Cornelius, I mean, they locked down everything with his file. I mean, we couldn't see anything, which I, at the moment, I was like, yeah, that makes sense. They don't want anyone doing anything, because now this is, of course, going to be under investigation. But that also, on the other hand, prevented anyone from possibly going to get proof of all the things we had already talked about, you know, and had been concerned about. So yeah, there's some connections. And not just with that. I mean, there were multiple other staff members who didn't do so great at other campuses. And, you know, that's why Sequel, when they said, oh, this was a Lakeside issue, that was hard for me to believe, because they knew certain staff members that were on our campus that really had issues at other campuses, and vice versa. You know, there was a staff member that had a lot of allegations on our campus and ultimately was fired by Sequel, and then picked back up a couple months later and put in a different campus as a director. So they let these people move around that had power because they were protected, and in turn protecting Sequel and the abuse that was happening.
I just want to really differentiate the difference between, like, they were involved in some bullshit, so we transferred them to, like, make it go away, and the difference between firing them, like, officially, publicly being like, it's okay, guys, we agree this person's no good, we won't let them work with our kids anymore, and then hiring them at another location. That is, like, beyond audacious. Respect, Sequel. I would do that shit if I were evil.
Yep. That was common. That was known. And again, there were, not to say that the actions that happened with Cornelius on that day were appropriate. I mean, it never should have happened. But at the same time, they were doing what the culture was. They were doing what their supervisors did. They were doing what was taught, and they were doing what had been protected for so long. So many staff got away with that same restraint pretty much, and that same abuse, and even more, and nothing ever happened. They pretty much got promoted. You would get raises if you, you know, were able to keep kids in line and were tough and, you know, do these kinds of things. Sequel just, they just proved it. You know, they prove it because they let this happen. And for them to say, we didn't know. Okay, well, then that's also an issue because of how many CPS reports you were having and you didn't know your campus was in trouble. You know, Sequel is a huge portion in this, a huge portion. They knew, they still know, they still have facilities open. They still have staff that should not be working with children. There's probably only one or two campuses that I could say are safe, and that's not because of Sequel. It's because of the staff that are there. But unfortunately, that doesn't make up for the hundreds of other kids that are currently in their care.
Yeah, well, I really hope everybody listening to this has maybe a better basis for understanding for how this shit goes, especially the survivors. It's hard for us to, you know, not just want the whole world to mob up on everybody in the video, right? From that, it was a personal experience because we're the kids in the cafeteria or we're him. However, there's also the two sides where you have to understand in cult environments that the activities that are reinforced are toxic. This is how, when we, especially with the IFB ones, we have all these pedophiles and everybody knew, or everybody was one of them. And then you also have these people that stay. It's like, you guys are like the U-types and the staffer we spoke to in the past, staying in like these abusive relationships to protect your kids. It's like you're in a marriage where I know I should leave. I'm trying to make it better. I'm just trying to buffer it for the kids or find a way for them to get out, but I can't leave my kids. And so there's two completely conflicting cultures, and it's because of each other that the other one exists. Like, you would have left if those guys weren't going to possibly kill your kids. If they were going to be safe without you, you could have left. But it's because those guys exist that the good guys wind up traumatizing the shit out of themselves with this.
Yeah, I mean, and it was a cult-like mindset is the perfect way to describe it, because you had to walk a very fine line. You know, there were absolutely times where I was like, okay, I can't speak up about this right now because then I'm going to lose my, you know, inside to knowing what's going on. You know, like, the staff and the students knew who couldn't be trusted, who couldn't, you know, this, that, and the third. And so you had to almost like behind the scenes protect the students. And that might have been me getting them for even extra phone calls was a privilege, you know, like, or taking them off campus, or, hey, I'm going to work tonight, I'll take a group down here to hang out with me, you know, and taking those students who I knew might be targeted. And there was a lot of staff that tried to do that. There was teachers, there was case managers, there was therapists who all kind of would slyly try to, hey, I'll pick up shifts, or hey, I'll do this, I'll take this kid, because of what that student, you know, had told us. But we weren't allowed to go say something, because then that's going to target the student and target us. And that, then I would have been kicked, you know, they would have found reason to get rid of us. There were even staff in my department that I fired, or I let go, or I pushed to go, because they were just like good people and I couldn't watch what was happening anymore. And I know to this day, they probably still hate me and that's fine. I could see, you know, of course their viewpoint, but really it's like, we just got people out that we could. That was honestly the end goal, is like, if you were a decent staff member and I saw that this wasn't going to go well for you, like, just leave. As much as I didn't want them to, you know, we couldn't. And I even built up my department, you know, like I brought in people who I knew had a little more background, and would stand up. And that's brought a lot of the issues, because now it wasn't just, you know, one or two of us. It was whole departments and whole groups really pushing back, and they couldn't silence us all. And that was, again, a good thing and a bad thing, because I also feel horrible that I, you know, brought people in and exposed them to this. But I needed help. Like I didn't know what else to do. And so many staff members felt that way. They would come to me and say, hey, Miss Maggie, you know, is blah, blah, blah doing okay? Or, you know, and there were times where we would, you know, share, hey, this student was supposed to have a visit this weekend and they didn't come. Let's try and be supportive. And the next thing, that's being thrown back in their face. You know, that's why no one loves you. And that happened a lot with Corn. You know, his family, you move a kid across the state, you can't always expect them to be able to come. And so it was a lot of, that's why no one wants you. That's why, you know, this happened to you, and that's going to beat any student down. And so that was another way we had to protect them, was to not give information. So yeah, it was very, I mean, an abusive relationship. We had to sometimes suck it up and bite our tongues to protect them in the long run. And I was not perfect. None of us were. I mean, we had to do what we had to do in that moment to try and get further and try and almost, like, I guess, bring it down from the inside. But like you said, it's just, when they're already there, it's already too late.
Are you familiar with the Stanford Prison Experiment?
Absolutely.
I feel like, and I hope that all of you have access to mental health resources right now, but I want you to remember is that we were in a social psychology experiment, and it was not put on by good doctors in a university at all. And for any people to voluntarily put themselves on the front lines of this psychological warfare to protect children for $12 an hour, I have a lot of respect for you for that. And I just hope you can give yourself a little bit of credit. And when you guilt yourself for dragging people into your burning house of an abusive relationship that's founded in a cult, literally, I hope maybe that this next stage of being part of this movement and really taking control of this narrative and trying to create a legislative or otherwise legacy for Cornelius, maybe you can be relieved, healed, or proud of encouraging and recruiting other staff to now come forward to save children.
I certainly hope so. I appreciate that. And, you know, like I said, I regret a lot of times that we're there. I regret a lot of things that happened directly after the incident. And I appreciate so much the staff that were able to use their voice after that happened. And, you know, even though it's taken a year, like I said, to get to this point, it just, I can't let it sit. I can't let not only Cornelius, but every other staff and every other youth that was there just, you know, be told, oh, get over it. You know, this is a memory. It was this, you know, whatever. At one point I was told that this is normal for the social work field and for the residential field. And clearly, I don't know how anyone could have the mindset that any of this was normal. So that kind of pushed me to really start speaking up and saying, this is not normal. This should never happen again. And honestly, it's not about me. I really want this to be out there for others to, again, speak up, to use their voice, whether you were at, you know, a residential facility 10 years ago, if you were there when things like this happened, if you were a parent, your voice is not silenced. The more that we speak up and the more that we push back on these multi-million dollar people that think they have this control and can buy this out and continue to do what they're going to do because they've done it for so long, we have to put our foots down. We have to make sure that there is never another Cornelius, that there is never another parent that has to get a phone call saying they just watched a peer die and they're scared for their life. We have to make sure there's never another, you know, staff who has to try to revive a student they have been pouring their hearts into, and make sure that there's not staff that take the blame for things that were systematically put in place in this culture to make money and get away with abuse. That's ultimately what this is. And I know for the states, it's extremely hard to have youth who need places to go. There are some very unfortunate circumstances. And if that's the case and we need quote unquote residentials, then we better have some things in place to make sure that this isn't happening. Because I promise you, workers were there almost every day and no one batted an eye. No one did anything. You know, it's just normalized that this is where the kids go and they're mostly quote unquote safe. And this is what we pay for. And the amount of people that even in Kalamazoo have lived here their whole lives, didn't know what Lakeside was. You know, I mean, this is things that our states put in place. There, you know, the fact that people from Tennessee and Indiana and Ohio and Minnesota, kids came from everywhere to Michigan. And not only did Michigan allow it, those states allowed it. And I can say that Oregon is probably the only one that fought us and came up there. And that's thanks to, you know, Senator Gelser. But our politicians, the people we put in place, they're paying for this. We are paying to put kids into traumatized, toxic situations. And it's just setting them up for the rest of their lives. And it's not to say that nothing good comes of it, because I know that there are some amazing students who built great relationships with staff who still have these mentors, you know, who still had somewhat of a, you know, a bed to lay on or whatever it may be. But in the end, it doesn't outweigh everything else that happened there. So we need to stop funding for places like this. And if we are funding places that children need to go to, you better not be making 7-8 plus figures a year while your staff are making $12 an hour and your kids are walking around without shoes and we run out of dinner.
Mic drop on that. Okay. Two questions. One, what can we, the community, do to help encourage more staff to speak out, which is honestly what I think is necessary to come at this from a criminal and a legislative angle? And then secondly, what can the community do to support the Lakeside community at large, the Kalamazoo community, the survivors of Lakeside? You guys are losing your kids. Is there anything that we can do that you can think of now that we could do?
Yeah, as far as other staff, I mean, that's just going to be a process. I think that the best thing we can do is to just keep validating people, just keep letting them know, no matter how big or small you feel like your story was, whether you were there for a month and couldn't take it, or whether you were there this whole time, that you're safe, first of all. So I think that's one of the biggest concerns, is you're speaking out against a nationwide multi-million dollar company. You don't know. You saw what happened there. So there's people that have, you know, families and kids. And so just coming forward in general is terrifying. It's hard. So I think that just continuing to let people know, again, that they can speak up again, whether it's the students, whether it's their parents, whether it's even, you know, workers, I know that there's DHS workers, adoption workers that I worked closely with that we had concerns, and I know they had concerns, but again, you know, we just had nothing to go off of. And so if you work for the state and you dealt with Lakeside, I know that you probably have something to share. I think another big thing is, of course, being able to have a platform that is anonymous. I know that you've talked to several staff and have been able to keep, you know, their anonymity. But for those people that do have, you know, are still in the field, still have a lot of concerns, things like that, maybe we could have some way that they could write in, email in, whatever they're, you know, they're comfortable with, so that we have something to kind of back up more of these stories. And as far as the community, a lot of, you know, almost all the staff are still around here. And I know that it's kind of, again, just been forgotten about, not for us, but as far as the community, I mean, Lakeside got closed. They think that's the end of it. I think unless they were really invested in the story and seeing what was going on and following Sequel, they just kind of thought this was one piece of the puzzle. So I think that for the staff and students, I'm hopeful that we can get some kind of memorial for Cornelius, something that really reminds us this happened here and we need to make sure it never happens again. And not only in Kalamazoo, I mean, all over. And I know that there are some artists in the community that, you know, have put him in some murals and we've talked about it a little bit, but I think we need something a little bit more permanent. And I know that there's some great agencies here that are working on that. And I think that's going to be really helpful for some of the healing portion of it. But I think the community, you know, I mean, this happened here. This happened in Kalamazoo. And just people need to know that it doesn't have to be your city and your state for you to make a change. It doesn't have to be directly impacted to you. You don't have to have a kid to care about kids in the system. You don't have to have been in the system to care about the system. And again, I hope anyone, you don't have to be from Michigan to care about Cornelius. You don't have to be from Michigan to speak up, you know, and help us put other things in place. And for all my Michigan folks, you can go speak everywhere else too. I know that, you know, I've talked with, you know, in councils in Philly and the Oregon and the Montana and the Missouri. And I think that's another barrier, is a lot of people think that you have to be involved in that specific thing. You have to live there. And that's not the case. We just need, more people to speak up. We need more people to show this compassion. And I feel that if there's really that support following it, we'll also be able to support more survivors coming forward. And those are the people that are going to have the biggest impact. Although, you know, I'm a survivor in some ways. I'm definitely did not go through what, again, so many of those youth have gone through. And I hope that they know that we see them and that their experiences were valid. And I'm sorry we couldn't do more, but we're trying now.
Responsibility and accountability are incredibly important to those of us terrorized with them. So I do want to validate the survivors who feel triggered by considering compassion for staff. I'd also like to remind most of us from the Cult Spawn Tough Love TTI that while our particular torture hubs were created and run by and tailored to protect predators, and it's improbable that good staff stay long, many people do devote their lives to child welfare. And as more and more public and state-licensed or state-run facilities are getting caught under the covers with our cult cousins, we will have more and more decent everyday people who have to choose whether to run from the burning house or stay with their kids until the smoke clears. If the state or our society would listen to our whistleblowers, they wouldn't be in the futile position of waiting for help to arrive. And furthermore, at least for myself and the other survivor from the family that I sappy-sobbed with last night, there are lights in the darkness. For us, Betty Rosengrant was the only person who saw us as children who needed love in a world full of people trying to beat us into submission. If it were not for her stubborn, stolen glances or the bracelet she gave me for my 18th birthday right before I walked, I don't know who I would be. When every single other human in my world was committed to turning me on myself, She was the only reason I didn't. Her angelic presence in my life is why we waited until her death to launch the podcast. I wish we hadn't. I wish I could have asked her why she stayed. But I think we know the answer. She stayed for us. And it has made all the difference. So thank you. Rest in peace and power, Betty. And rest in peace and power, Cornelius Frederick. We hope that everyone who hears this or stumbles upon justice for Cornelius will join us in this mission to legislate a legacy for this young man so that he will stand between those who would abuse children and future survivors. It's all too little too late. That's why participation is required. The power is yours. May the force be with us all.